thank you for all coming. This is a really packed house. That's a really wonderful audience. They must have advertised really well. I hope most of you are here by your own volition. Can everyone hear me okay? Yeah, you can hear me? Oh, speak up. Does thumbs up mean it's good or speak up? All right, a few questions to ask. In answering these questions, before you just did, like, can you hear me? And your decision or lack of decision to laugh, was that voluntary or involuntary? When you chose the seat that you sat in, how did you arrive at that seat? You fortunate seat sitters. Standing people, are you disappointed? You arrived with a pre-planned idea to have a seat, which has been deprived. How did you know which seat you were going to sit in? Are these sort of decisions and influences voluntary, non-voluntary, caused by free will? It was the only seat available, and you were the last one in the room, so you were very lucky. It was one of you right here. You had less of a choice than others. These are questions to have in mind and be thinking about throughout this talk. Is just, what do you even mean by free will, and what kind of connection does it have to these ordinary practices and activities that you do? How do you think about free will as it's performative? Is free will something you experience? Or is it more something that's explanatory of other things you experience? Do you think more in terms of the voluntary and the non-voluntary, involuntary, or maybe the intentional, unintentional? Which of these are concepts that are articulating something that's descriptive of what you actually experience, that you perform, as opposed to something that's meant to be explanatory? Not necessarily something you experience, but explains those things that you experience. How do you think about free will? Tonight I'm going to defend a traditional understanding of free will. It's important, though, that it's a traditional understanding. There are lots of traditional understandings. I defend this account of free will against some neuroscientists and philosophers. The some is also an important quantifier here, who have claimed that neuroscience has shown us or demonstrated or disproved free will and have shown it as illusion. My critique here is neither against philosophy itself, and it's also not a critique of neuroscience. I think both are indispensable disciplines for thinking about human persons. Rather, it's a criticism for what I take to be mistaken positions in philosophy and neuroscience that have purported to disprove free will. Important questions for us to ask here are, whose philosophical conception of free will? Or maybe you think it's actually mistaken already to say that philosophers have some proprietary claim about free will. So you might just say, whose concept of free will? And furthermore, which interpretation of free will or the neuroscience of free will? Because there's a rival sets of interpretations, as we'll see, of some of these experiments that have been conducted. There's not a hegemony of concept, just one concept of free will that dominates the literature, whether in philosophy or in neuroscience. And there's not just one interpretation. It's very complicated. One question to ask about free will and trying to resolve this question is, free will something you experience, or is it something we sort of bring in to explain sort of under the hood what's going on in some of the actions that we perform, like these voluntary or intentional ones? One way to answer this question is to think, when did theorists first start talking about free will? Plato and Aristotle have really extensive detailed accounts of voluntary agency, of types of acts when you know it's the right thing to do, but your passions just sort of drive you and overwhelm you, and you do the thing you didn't think was the right thing to do. But they don't have an articulated concept of free will. So two theorists writing in the 4th century BC extensively, having different views about voluntary action and its relationship to knowledge and involuntary action, about the moral character of the ability to have voluntary responsible actions, don't articulate or conceive of what they're doing in terms of free will. Did they just miss something? Or is the concept not necessary? Does it add something new to the discipline? So it's always important to ask, we might think that free will is just so obvious, it's so basic. But yet, many theorists who write at length about responsibility and agency and these things don't necessarily have an articulated concept of free will. It's one that developed later on. And it might be a necessary, really helpful concept. Maybe they were missing something in their inquiries, but it does raise questions to what degree is free will something experiential? And in this development, there's all these rival and incompatible conceptions of free will. So if we want to think about, has neuroscience disproven free will, we should first ask, which concept of free will was being operative here? And by showing that's problematic, does it necessarily show all conceptions of free will are problematic? In other words, which concept of free will is operationalized in the experiments of various neuroscientists? And we're going to look at a very particular strand of experiments that started in the 1980s and have continued in more sophisticated iterations. But what I'm going to suggest, and not go into too much detail on, is that these experiments have continued to use the same basic concept of free will, and they've been continually operationalized even as the experiments have gotten more sophisticated. So in one respect, some of the things we're going to cover in this talk don't just apply to experiments that were done in the 80s or experiments that have been done just in the last few years. They also potentially apply to future experiments. So the conceptual resources we'll go through will apply, so I'm contending, to any experiments that continue to operationalize this particular set of concepts of free will. In the outline of my talk, I'm just going to briefly sort of do a quick overview of different claims that have been made by philosophers and neuroscientists about free will skepticism. And then I'm going to turn to these famous experiments done by Benjamin Libet, some of the first results of which were published in papers in Brain and Behavioral Sciences and other things in 1983, and there have been lots of other iterations of these over the last three decades. And then we're going to look at a particular line of criticism, which I'm going to call Libet's inhibited sneeze theory of free will critique, and see that there's certain problems in the very concept of free will that's operationalized in these experiments. So let's just begin thinking about the relationship of neuroscience and free will skepticism. One of the first things we need to discharge is claims that neuroscience has discovered all sorts of exciting, interesting things. But it's not a discovery recently, in the last 100 years or even the last few decades, that the brain is somehow important for cognition or thought or emotion. That's not a significant insight. Already in the Hippocratic writings, we find from the 5th century and 4th centuries BC, quotes like this. This is from his Hippocratic writings from the short work on the sacred disease, which was a study of epileptic seizures and trying to understand their biological basis, as well as not necessarily rule out some divine inspiration. But in the Hippocratic writings, we have this quote. "We ought to know that from nothing else but from thence come joys, delights, laughter, and sports, and sorrows, griefs, despondency, and lamentations. And by this, in a special manner, we acquire wisdom and knowledge, and see and hear, know what are foul and what are fair, what are bad and what are good, what are sweet and what unsavory. All these things we endure from the brain." So it's not news that the nervous system, well, he's not thinking about the nervous system, he's thinking about whatever that squishy stuff is inside the head. This is somehow indispensable and relevant to all these psychological experiences. So whatever neuroscience is teaching us, it's not teaching us that. It might be giving us much more fine-grained specifications on if you have issues with your medial temporal lobe, it might cause various forms of degeneration and autobiographical memory. So we might be able to be much more fine-grained about these things. But just the point of the brain is not a discovery, or at least not a recent one. This is a very nice little book if people want to take pictures of this, but this is a helpful book if you want to see some of the literature. This is written by Alfred Mailey, who has spent the last few decades studying neuroscience contributions to free will literature. It's a short little book that Oxford University Press published not too long ago, and it goes through a range of the different experiments and evaluates them. But one of the things that Mailey helpfully says here is almost everyone who believes in free will believes the brain plays an indispensable role in generating decisions. If a soul is involved, it works through the brain somehow. The challenge that neuroscience supposedly poses to free will can't be based simply on the idea that brains are at work in decision-making. Nevertheless, coming from a very different perspective, the cognitive neuroscientist Michael Gonzanaga in his Gifford lectures, Who's in Charge, says, "Neuroscience reveals that the concept of free will is without meaning. It's time to get over the idea of free will and move on." Michael Gonzanaga is a very famous cognitive neuroscientist. He coined the phrase cognitive neuroscience and has published some of the most important literature. Every about 5 or 6, 10 years, a new edition of major works on cognitive neuroscience. He's anthologized over the last since the late 1970s.
Green and Cohen write, "Free will, as we ordinarily understand it, is an illusion." Sam Harris, in his short popular book on free will, has written, "We do not know what we intend to do until the intention arises. To understand this, we realize that we are not the authors of our thoughts and actions in the way that people generally suppose. Did I consciously choose coffee over tea? No. The choice was made for me by events in my brain that I, as the conscious witness of my thoughts and actions, could not inspect or influence." It's also been stated that what are the consequences of realizing that physical determinism negates our ability to choose freely? Pretty radical consequences. What's seriously affected is our idea of moral responsibility, which should be discarded along with the idea of free will. So not only do they think that these experiments have undermined free will, but they also have a large-scale implications. You get rid of moral responsibility, you should get rid of the criminal justice system. I mean, the kind of massive scale implications of this, if it actually is true. So it's not just an academic philosophy seminar room kind of curiosity as to whether or not this is true or false. It would have really significant implications on your life. And you should think about, when you go hear these lectures, what do you do the next day after you are or not convinced of these sorts of things? If you really believe these things are true, does it have any impact? But of course, if it does have any impact, why is that? Is it because you decided that these were good arguments? Maybe you can't decide that they're good arguments, or you decide they're good arguments, but then they have rational compelling force and they transform the way you behave thereafter. Or, and you did it freely, or maybe it was just an illusion that you did it freely, but there's just a coercive force. So I'm hoping tonight that either you freely decide that these are good arguments, or that the rational force is so fantastic that it's coercive, and then you believe free will from now on else because of the coercive force of the arguments. Interestingly enough, for what it's worth, as if philosophical arguments could be solved by democratic vote, it is worth noting that not too long ago, a survey, it's getting on now, as I discovered earlier, a point I made about a hurricane I experienced, someone else said, oh yeah, I was in middle school when that happened, and I had just started grad school. But anyway, so 2009 is a while ago, I guess, now. But any case, the majority of philosophers, at least in English-speaking countries, defend a view called compatibilism, where they think that free will is compatible either with the physical universe being deterministic or with the physical universe being indeterministic. So despite this sort of neuroscience evidence, there's still a majority of philosophers who either defend a version of compatibilism or a lesser group who defend a pretty aggressive version of free will called libertarian free will. So that's sort of just a brief survey of the kind of skepticism and where the chips lay, at least democratically speaking, of people voting in for what they think about these sorts of views. But also the serious consequences of whether or not this did prove to be the case, and if we actually acted on it, whether we acted on it freely or acted on it through coercion. So let's look at some of these experiments. In particular, I'm going to look at the experiments that Libet started doing in the mid-1980s, and we'll do our own version of this experiment here and now. It won't be nearly as fun or as sophisticated, but we'll at least walk through the steps of it. So the question you might want to ask, thinking earlier about the question of, did you come here freely? Were you compelled to come here? I didn't see anyone like hogtied and picked up and carried and sat down in a chair, but to what degree was it voluntary that you came here? Were you influenced by others, and did that undermine your freedom? Did someone promise to get you a drink afterwards if you would come to this? And then when you did find your seat, did you have to think about every step along the way? Did you have to think right foot, left foot, right foot, but you know that, like right foot up about 6 inches, that'd be a pretty high step, but right foot up about 3 inches, and then a little bit further. How much these actions are free, and how much pre-planning is required? And before you were aware of that you did voluntarily sit in the chair, did you have to first become aware of the plan or the thought to sit down in the chair? Or did you just sit down in the chair? And perhaps now that's not a free action, it's an involuntary one. Think about these kinds of questions as you reflect on this question: how might we conduct a neuroscience experiment of free will? One thing, given the conception of free will that Libet and his colleagues started with, is they thought that free will seems to require that our conscious volitions, our conscious willings, it's these conscious ones that seem to initiate and cause our voluntary behavior. So you kind of have a conscious thought of what you want to do, and then it happens. You have a conscious thought of, I'm going to do this, I'm going to go walk over there and sit in that chair, and then you walk over there and sit in that chair. The thought was, but maybe our brain causes these movements somehow before we're conscious of our volition to move. So what happens first when I involuntarily move my hand at the starting line? Is it my thought? Is it my brain? It's unlikely it's the hand. That's probably the one coming in last. But what's the order here? Is free will first? Does my conscious volition to move my hand happen before my brain triggers my hand to move? Or is the brain first? Does my brain trigger my hand to move before I am conscious of the volition to move my hand? If free will is first, clearly the conscious volition happens first, and that somehow causes the brain, something in the motor cortex, and that sends signals down, and it causes the hand to move. If my conscious volition to move my hand is before my brain, which triggers my fingers or my hand to move, then it seems that free will is safe by Libet's lights. My conscious volition is what initiates, which starts and causes or brings about my movement. But what happens if the brain is first? If my brain triggers my hand to move before I am conscious of a volition to move my hand, then it would seem that free will is an illusion, because my brain is what initiates my movements prior to my conscious volition to move. My conscious volition isn't actually what's causing my hand to move. I just think that, and I'm deceived. So that's the basic kind of thought process that's going through in the design of this experiment. These sort of concepts of free will and causation of hands and their relationship to each other, that's what's motivating the way in which the experimental design came into being. So Libet wants to design a neuroscience experiment to test these claims about free will. Can we empirically test whether the brain initiates movements before the conscious volition to move? Now, Libet had done a lot of work on the supplementary motor cortex and other things, and he knew that triggering causes, which are called readiness potential, and this is literature that had already been going on and discovered some decades before Libet was doing these experiments. He knew that triggering causes, this readiness potential of a bodily movement, it could be detected in the brain and supplementary motor cortex up to 1 second before the bodily motion. So this is independent of these experiments about free will. It's just something you could, before an actual muscle burst would occur in a finger and a hand, you could be detecting it with an EEG cap or other things in the supplementary motor cortex. So this raised the question, quote, the question whether conscious awareness of the voluntary urge or intention to act also appears with such similar advanced timing. So the problem became, how can we experimentally distinguish between the time of this readiness potential in the brain, someone's conscious volition to move, and then the timing of the hand? So you have three different times you want to try to locate. You have to find a way to individuate each of them temporally, and then which one comes first, which one comes second, which one comes third. So this is a basic, cartoon of the apparatus they have. You're going to detect the EEG, you're going to use an EEG to detect the readiness potential and the supplementary motor cortex. You're going to use an EMG attached to the hand or the wrist or close to the muscles of the fingers to detect the movement there. But the tricky part was, how do you detect when the conscious intention occurs? How do you detect when the person is aware of their urge or their decision, their intention to move? And that's going to happen with this fancy Libet clock, which we're going to get to in just a second. So we need to track, when does the brain trigger us to move? When does the conscious volition of being aware of your urge to move? And when is the movement in the wrist? Okay. Imagine now, we're going to do this Libet experiment. If anyone has any concerns, you can sign a waiver afterwards. But for now, you'll be fine. Whether you do it freely or, coercively is another matter. But there's four things to point out about this experiment we're going to imagine ourselves doing. So it is like a philosophy seminar room, because now we're not doing real experiments, just thought experiments. So first, there's an EEG cap on your head. This is going to detect the readiness potential, which is the electrical activity in your brain that causes a bodily movement. As you can imagine, see, I chose images where everyone's having a good time with the EEG cap that's on their head. Second, you need to consciously scan and introspectively wait for an awareness of an urge or tug or desire or wish, a conscious volition or intention to move your finger. So everyone, you know, put your hands on your lap, put your hand on your knee if you can. Standers, I'm sorry, you're excluded from the experiment. We always have to throw out some experimental subjects that just don't cooperate, but everyone else, you can put your hand on your knee. Now third, you have to watch, and I hope my computer doesn't crash, you have to watch the dot go around the Libet clock. Now, you know, his clock was much better than mine, and it didn't do it in such a jarring way, but all right. So you're going to have to watch where the dot's running around on the clock. And then fourth, your arm or your hand is hooked up to an EMG, and this is going to detect the muscle contractions. Okay, so now we got to get you your instructions for this experiment. Everyone's ready? Rest one of your hands on your knee, wait for one complete revolution of the spot on the Libet clock, and then perform a quick, abrupt, spontaneous flexion of your finger or your wrist. All right, wait just a second, don't do it yet. Make sure the flexion is spontaneous, and then I'm now quoting to the actual instructions that Libet and others gave to the subjects of the experiment. Let the urge to act appear on its own at any time without pre-planning or concentration on when to act. Try to be spontaneous. If you're not spontaneous, we're going to throw you out with the people that are standing over there. In deciding when to perform each act, this instruction is designed to elicit voluntary acts that are freely capricious in origin. And then he also tells us that the subject was asked to note and later report the time of appearance of his conscious awareness of wanting to perform a given self-initiated movement. The experience was also described as an urge or an intention or decision to move. The subjects usually settled for the words wanting or urge. And you can't pre-plan, okay? You can't wait for it to go one time around and then go, I'm going to move on the 15, okay? I'm going to move on the 15, on the 20. You need to let it go and just wait for the urge. And as soon as you feel the urge or the desire, the wish to move, move it then, okay? I don't see anybody moving their hands. All right. These were the results of Libet's experiment, and they've proved to be pretty robust ever since. I mean, there's a lot of other nuances that this experiment has had to acquire over the decades. But what typically robustly occurred is that the brain triggered, the readiness potential was discovered to occur about 550 milliseconds before the EMG detected a muscle burst in the arm or the wrist. In second place came the conscious volition, subjects reporting the time on the clock when they felt that urge. That seemed to occur only 200 milliseconds before the actual movement. And then, of course, the movement occurred right there, so we can see how things turned out. So said otherwise, the readiness potential in the brain was detected about 550 milliseconds before the movement and about 350 milliseconds before the appearance of a reportable time of awareness of a subjective intention or a wish to act. So first happened the triggering of the brain, all those conscious volitions or urges you all felt to move your finger, that happened right after, 350 milliseconds after the readiness potential in the brain. Libet concluded that the brain evidently decides to initiate, or at the least, prepare to initiate to act at a time before there is any reportable subjective awareness that such a decision has taken place. It is concluded that cerebral initiation of even spontaneous voluntary act of the kind studied here can and usually does begin unconsciously. Now, some very important caveats. Caveats that are often not made when other people report Libet's findings, either in a positive light or in a skeptical light of what they seem to bring about. Importantly, Libet did not claim his experiments covered the whole range of voluntary actions that are often purportedly attributed to free will. For example, Libet's experiments do not address non-motor voluntary acts, like deciding the next move in chess before you actually do it, or planning one's day before actually doing it, or working out a math problem, okay? Actions that don't necessarily involve overt motor actions. His experiment, he said, has nothing to do with them. You'd have to do a different set of experiments to look at that, which have been done, actually. Libet's experiments also do not address pre-planned movements. So if you think pre-planned movements are at least part of the indispensable story of voluntary actions, if you think moral actions often involve pre-planned actions, Libet's experiments aren't about those pre-planned actions either. Often, then, what gets introduced is a distinction between picking and choosing. There's no free will for arbitrary picking to move something, like just lifting up your finger or moving your wrist. But it leaves untouched whether we have free will for rationally choosing to move. Any movement may be performed for some moral reason. Remember, you weren't supposed to plan. You weren't supposed to wait for one revolution and then move your finger at 15. It was supposed to be capricious. Third, Libet's experiments left open the possibility of vetoing the movements initiated non-consciously by the brain. He writes, "There could be a conscious veto that aborts the performance even of the type of spontaneous self-initiated act under study here." So you might be sitting there, you might feel the urge to move, but then instead of actually moving, you stop yourself. You don't actually move your finger. And as they often said, then it seems what Libet's saying is, well, there's no free will, there is free won't. That's the idea. Libet's claimed his experiments disprove free will initiates spontaneous motor actions, but these experiments said, just by way of review, it doesn't touch non-motor voluntary actions. It doesn't touch pre-planned, rational, or reason-giving actions or choices. And you have free won't, the ability to veto spontaneously triggered brain movements. More recently, Patrick Haggard and other colleagues in London have done experiments that also try to say you don't have free won't either. But I'm not going to look at those experiments, but they still are, they're operationalizing the same basic concept of how free will works. So I think a lot of they are more sophisticated experiments without a doubt, but the same sort of concepts are being operationalized. So if my criticism of the concepts apply to the Libet ones, I think they also apply to the Haggard ones. The response to this has been varied. There's both experimental problems that others have raised against them, but there's also a range of philosophical problems. The philosophical problems focus in on saying that this is a confused concept of free will or the voluntary of intentions or desires, that there's many alternative interpretations of these experiments that don't have the sort of extraordinary claim that there's no free will, at least not of this non-planned motor kind even. And there's also claims that there's overgeneralizations. And some of these overgeneralizations are not Libet's. They're just people who fail to read Libet carefully. And the last paragraph of the BBS paper is pretty clear. They just ignore that. There's also a lot of experimental problems, some of which have been fixed through the more sophisticated versions of the experiments. There are a lot of questions you might raise about the ability of us to actually adequately time and look at the clock. But more sophisticated versions have worked their way out of those. And then there's been some problems with the statistical analysis as well that's been done. I'm going to look at the kind of problems having to do with the very concept that's being operationalized, the very concept of free will that Libet seems to be taking for granted. So the two types of philosophical criticisms are some that endorse the concept of free will operationalized in Libet experiments. So what the concept of free will is that's used, they think that that's more or less the right concept of free will. But they think that there's still issues, that the consequences aren't as significant. And some would be these sort of causal problems. There's a variety of different sort of issues that those approaches take. That's not the kind of philosophical critique I'm going to offer tonight. I'm going to offer more of the second kind of critique. I'm going to reject the very concept of free will that's operationalized in these Libet-style experiments. So it's going to contend that these experiments actually have nothing to do with free will because they mistakenly operationalize what they presume to be the right concept of free will, but it's in fact a description of a phenomenon unrelated to free will. So they have a concept that they think captures the phenomena that we all call free will, but I'm saying they've captured the wrong phenomenon. It's not the phenomenon that we care about when we talk about free will. They captured another one. And hence, Libet actually has more like a concept of free will that he confused with what in fact is an effort to sort of inhibit a sneeze. So we're calling this Libet's inhibited sneeze theory of free will. So to do this, we have to step back a bit and ask, what would an alternative version, what I'm claiming is a more accurate account of free will, where should we start instead? first we need to start with voluntary actions and then move to free will. Free will is not something we experience. We experience ourselves as performing voluntary actions. Free will is something we bring in to explain those things we do experience. The difference between voluntary actions we perform versus involuntary and non-voluntary. So we first need to sort of do a really complicated, large inventory of the different kind of behaviors we engage in. The ones that include voluntary psychological behavior, non-voluntary psychological behavior, and involuntary psychological behavior. We need to consult jurisprudence literature and court cases. We need to think about the range of different kinds of behaviors human beings engage in, and the way in which we try to demarcate, both in a popular way and a more theoretical way, how do we distinguish all of these different types of psychological behaviors? But also what we need to do to understand voluntary, involuntary, and non-psychological behaviors, not in this sort of static sense of just looking at human adults. We need to understand the way in which our capacities to perform voluntary, non-voluntary, involuntary actions develop ontogenically, and how they arise from the integration of various diverse biological, psychological, and social developments of us as dependent, rational animals. So for instance, I mean, we're not going to go through this kind of inquiry, it would take forever. We need to think about what's required for a human being to even engage in the kind of things we stereotypically call voluntary actions. And this is just a real rough sketch, but we start off early on as neonates, and all we can really engage in are just mere motor movements, reflex grasping, sucking, facial imitation, flailing, writhing. These are rather uncontrolled, spontaneous sorts of movements, which we don't have a type of voluntary control. The category of voluntary doesn't even really apply at this level. Those develop into sort of more mere controlled motor movements of hands, arms, legs, necks, torso, of trying to look at things, drawing our attention to things, trying to reach for objects and not just moving spontaneously or randomly. And then we eventually develop minimal controlled sensory motor coordination of reaching, of grabbing, of manipulating. And this slowly develops into our basic forms of purposeful controlled sensory motor coordination, like crawling and walking, running, imitation, various kinds of attempts to speak before we actually speak words properly. These are all efforts that we make long before we have memory of our early life and development that are integral to what it took for any of us to engage in the acts we call voluntary or involuntary. Finally, we, at certain stages, begin to engage in rationally purposeful activities that have normative characteristics and proper intentional actions. There's a lot of investment that people made in our lives to make us into voluntary agents. And if we want to understand voluntary action, we need to understand the way in which it arises in these complex biological, psychological, and social contexts and factors that are involved in it. But that's not enough even. We also need to do a comparison of voluntary psychological behavior of humans and look at the range of types of voluntary, involuntary, and non-voluntary activities of various animals. So it's a really complicated kind of inquiry. And these sort of factors about the voluntary have been excluded from the concept of free will that Libet's interested in, that hasn't been involved in the concept that's being deployed there. Libet's largely endorsing and inheriting that concept from a lot of philosophical accounts that aren't really interested in having these be part of the story of what free will means. And even that story of this comparative approach isn't enough, because our description of voluntary action is already a bit of an abstraction. It's an abstraction from the way in which perception, motor abilities, emotions, motivations, beliefs, desires, and knowledge, which also need to be understood in a developmental sense. All of that also, there's a nexus of these concepts to actually talk about these phenomena. Those would have to be brought in as well if we wanted to adequately account for what voluntary action is. So given that, all we can do tonight is present an extraordinarily misleading and distorted caricature of what a fuller inquiry like that might look like. We're going to use this distinction between doings and happenings. This is a good start, but it would have to be problematized if we did a more thoroughgoing philosophy of intentional action. So what I'm telling you is this is enough for us to critique the Libet experiments, but it would be inadequate if we wanted to go all the way through and tell a more comprehensive story. Briefly, human actions are things we do versus acts of a human are things that happen to us.
I think coming in here and sitting in the room is something that we, each individual did. It was something you were doing. What would happen to you is if you were coerced, somebody picked you up and brought you in here. But there's other kinds of happenings that aren't so much as coercive, but just feeling a pain, having a headache. That's something that occurs to you, something that happens to you. It's not something necessarily coercive. Human actions are actions we do or perform voluntarily, like walking, speaking, promising, purchasing, stealing. Whereas acts of a human are acts that happen to us involuntarily, so against our will, or non-voluntarily. Feelings, urges, emotions, pangs of hunger, exhaustion, slipping, falling, getting wet. These are all things that happen. Briefly, the voluntary actions are roughly, if we had to lay out some criteria, they're actions we rationally control, we do willingly or intentionally for reasons. You might not be thinking the reason when you're doing the action, but you could give the reason. You wouldn't just be confabulating or making it up. Why did you do that? You give an answer and it's not made up. It really was the reason, even if you weren't thinking it. They're typically things you can do or refrain from doing. They're self-initiated and self-determined. And so this is why we call them free. We're accountable or we're responsible for the actions that we do voluntarily. A fully voluntary action is one in which the agent controls its inception. So why did you start doing the action in the way that you're doing it? It's something you control the continuation of, and it's something you control the cessation or the termination of it, of when you stop performing the action. Hence, sneezing is only a partly voluntary action, in as much as one can inhibit a sneeze, but you can't initiate it directly. Okay, so actions can not necessarily, the voluntary isn't necessarily the part you initiate. Sometimes it's the way in which you execute it. If you have a violent urge to vomit, hopefully you can have the voluntary control to direct it, but that's actually not always possible. But the initiation of that urge and that feeling is not something that you initiated voluntarily. And the point is not undermined by the idea of taking an emetic or a sneeze you could, you know, initiate by smelling an allergen. That's an indirect form of initiation, not like just sitting here and just causing yourself to sneeze is what he's saying there. So next comes the question of how important are conscious antecedents to your voluntary actions? How important is it that you had to think of what you were going to do before you did it in order to it be a voluntary action? Most voluntary actions and most intentional actions are not preceded by any kind of antecedent intention, at least not one that you thematize or think about or articulate to yourself. One merely acts. To act intentionally does not require the conscious formation of an antecedent intention any more than it requires antecedent deliberation decision. So thinking about when you came here this evening, how much did you have to think out ahead of time all the sort of steps to get here? Was that necessary? I mean, it's not saying you never do that, but is that something you had to do in order to have a voluntary action? Are you always, I mean, is your mental life that busy and occupied that you're always thinking through every single step before you do any sort of movement or action? Or is that not necessarily a requirement for voluntary action? Part of this answer is what you have to answer for yourself experientially. What are your experiences like? Do you have to do that? Is that a feature of your voluntary intentional actions? If we were to have done this large inquiry, I'm suggesting now we would be in a place to start talking about free will. Everything we've been talking about so far is only leading up to a discovery or a discussion of informing an adequate concept of free will. Free will is not the thing we experience. These other sort of performative things we've been describing so far, which are very contentious, and I've not given you arguments, I've just gone through a series of distinctions, each one of which is very contentious. But they're all features that I hope are experiential, that you can reflect on, seeing that I'm cornering phenomena that you've experienced. Free will is not one of the things you experience. It's meant to come in to help explain this variety of things I'm calling voluntary. These free or voluntary actions are performed by humans in virtue of an ability or a capacity that we exercise that's called will or free will. So that's why Plato and Aristotle, who maybe weren't interested in talking about the power, they could talk about all this other stuff, this voluntary responsible action, but they just, for whatever reason, didn't seem compelled to look for actually positing some power or capacity called free will. So on this account, it's contentious, but on this account I'm saying free will is a power or capacity in virtue of which humans are able to perform voluntary actions. In other words, voluntary human actions or doings are acts of free will, whereas the involuntary happenings, things that occur to you, whether endogenously or something from outside, being aware of a pain versus like someone causing pain in you or on you. Those are types of happenings, not things that are doings. So let's go back to Libet now. Recall for Libet, the subjects were, quote, to choose to perform a motor act at any time that the desire, urge, decision, and will should arise in them. They were also free not to act out of any given urge or initial decision to act. Each subject was instructed to watch for and report the earliest appearance of an awareness in question. But if what I'm right about this account of voluntary versus involuntary actions that we've been describing so far, feelings or urges of volition are neither necessary nor are they sufficient for voluntary actions. Before you walked into the room, you didn't have to first have an urge that you were aware of to walk in the room. It's not like some menu item came up and said, go in room or don't go in room, and you selected the go in room, and then that's what you did. I mean, that's a caricature of the view. But the view is saying, all of our voluntary actions are preceded by these conscious intentions or urges that you feel, and then you act on the basis of them, rather than you just walk into rooms. And people say, why did you do that? It's not that the answer required having had formed, well, I was going to go sit down in the lecture hall. You just did it. The reasoning is part of the embodied experience of what you were doing. It's not something you had to think about ahead of time. But the Libet experiments require, for voluntary motor actions to be free, you had to first be aware of this conscious urge or intention. That's what made it the kind of act that you thought was free. Furthermore, such feelings and urges are not human actions, but on this account that I'm giving, contrary to Libet, they're occurrences to human. They're happenings, like hunger, tiredness, bowel movements, and the feeling of an impending sneeze. So in other words, feeling an urge, for example, to sneeze just before one sneezes does not make the sneeze and its initiation voluntary. Indeed, although normal human beings can voluntarily inhibit a sneeze, they cannot sneeze at will at all. So strikingly, Libet's theory would in effect assimilate all human voluntary action to the status of inhibited sneezes or sneezes which one did not choose to inhibit. So he's using the concept free will, but he's describing a phenomenon that's not characteristic of voluntary actions at all. It's of these urges and these other factors which are just occurrences, happenings to humans. For in his view, all human movements are initiated by the brain before any awareness of a desire to move. And all that is left for voluntary control is the inhibiting or the permitting of the voluntary movement that's already underway. In sum, Libet-style experiments are not experiments about free will or free won't, but about urges, inclinations, conscious proposals or other acts of the humans, that is, happenings. So I'm saying that what he thought were acts and he thought his experiments were operationalizing and focusing on and eliciting, he was eliciting some phenomenon, but it wasn't the voluntary ones. It was more like these urges, more like these promptings, things that aren't necessarily characteristic of voluntary actions at all. Consequently, these Libet-style experiments, not just his, but any experiments that operationalize the same kind of concept of free will, which requires an antecedent awareness of a conscious intention, if I'm right that that's not an adequate account of free will, then all the other experiments that have been developed in the last 3 decades since then that still employ the same concept, they're open to these same sorts of objections. They've just missed the phenomenon of free will, of voluntary actions. They're describing a different one. This doesn't mean, though, that there can't be neuroscience experiments about free will, or at least on the concept of free will that I've been putting forward is, I think, the more adequate, more accurate accounts of free will. You could develop an experiment, but these are some of the difficulties that would be required for getting over it. So if any of you are sophisticated neuroscientists, you know, you can come back to me in 5 or 10 years after you know, and say, even De Haan's view about free will has been disproven. And I'd love to come back and talk to all of you about that. But what neuroscience experiments on free will should not overlook are these issues. In contrast to Libet-style experiments, they need to accurate descriptions of conscious voluntary actions. They need to adequately distinguish in some way or another voluntary doings from involuntary happenings in a way that is just masked and concealed by the way in which Libet and others are conceptualizing voluntary action. But also in contrast to Libet-style experiments, they need to rule out the causal role of intentional actions nested within other intentional actions. What I mean is, we're all engaged in numerous projects and long-term and short-term goals that have an influence on our behavior. You have both proximate and distal intentions. A simple example is, I'm walking across the street, but while walking across the street, I'm also engaged in another action simultaneously. Namely, I'm walking across the street to take a cab to the airport, but I'm simultaneously doing that because I'm also at the same time doing that for the purpose of to check in for a flight to San Francisco. And so at the same time, to go through security so I can board a flight to San Francisco so I can get to Stanford University to deliver a paper on neuroscience and free will. And that's just part of an even larger set of projects. So all these intentions have things that I'm doing for the sake of doing something else, many of which I'm doing simultaneously. They're all moments or parts within a larger sort of nested set of intentions I'm engaged in. And the reason why this is a problem, well, I'll come back to that in a second. So what's not ruled out by the Libet experiments is that the subjects were doing that too in the Libet experiment. Namely, any of the subjects that showed up for the, well, now it would be like a 25, well, I don't, how much money do you guys get for doing experiments? In Cambridge, they were always cheap. You'd get like £20 Amazon card or something like that. But maybe it's much better at Stanford, I'm not sure. We're in the old country where, you know, don't have as much money for these kind of fancy things. But anyway, you participate in the Libet experiment. Why? Because you want that £20 Amazon card or something like that, and you have anything better to do in the afternoon. But when you do that, you're given a set of instructions. And so in the experiment itself, what are you doing simultaneously is you're intending to follow Libet's experiments, his instructions. So what do I do? I intend to wait for an urge to move my wrist. Normally when I move my wrist, I don't do that, but Libet told me to do that, so I'm doing that in this experiment right now. And this might cause or prime my supplementary motor cortex to cause me to have an urge, which, due to my prior intention I was given by Libet's instructions, I interpret this urge as a volition, as a choice, to move my wrist. And since I'm already intending to move my wrist, once I feel or become aware of the urge to move my wrist, I move my wrist. After I become aware of this urge that I'm intending to wait to have occur to me, because Libet instructed me to do it, and I'm a good rule follower, and so I'm following all of this. So I intended to wait for a conscious urge to move my wrist. The point is that by giving the instructions to the subjects, and then voluntarily following the instructions and doing the experiment to their best of their abilities, the standards can't do it because they're not seated, but everyone else is following those instructions, that might also be causing a whole array of influences on your nervous system and other psychological states, none of which can be ruled out as also maybe factors that are causing the priming in the supplementary motor cortex amongst other phenomena. So these sort of factors aren't being controlled for at all in the experiment, and the difficulty is, how would you control for those factors? You have to give these instructions to the subjects so that they actually engage in that, and you can't rule out their ability to follow instructions in order to conduct the very experiment. So those are the obstacles and the difficulties that I think are involved that would have to be overcome if we were to develop adequate experiments about voluntary and intentional action, which were meant to try to show or disprove the role and the integration of the nervous system with voluntary action. Okay? So I'm going to conclude there. What we briefly went through is just sort of some of the neuroscience skepticism and the radical implications that some think have if we can disprove free will from neuroscience, like there is no moral responsibility, some extraordinary claims. I looked at what the Libet experiments were, and you all were good participants, and so there's free drinks out there that we've provided for you for having participated in this experiment. And went through, and I mean, the gist of this is that there are rival concepts of free will, and what concept of free will do you think is adequate to your own experiences of what you take to be serious features of voluntary, involuntary, responsible, non-responsible actions, the ones you can be accountable for versus the ones that are not? And do you think that the Libet experiments are operationalizing the kind of free will that you care about, the kind of voluntary moral actions that you care about? Is that what's characteristic of these kinds of experiments? Or have they misdescribed the phenomenon entirely and they've labeled it free will, but it's actually more like the kind of things that none of you would consider to be the voluntary responsible actions? Few people get in trouble because they have a sneeze, you know, about ready to occur. But those aren't the kind of actions that we typically care about as being the ones that you would be responsible for. It's these other kinds of actions, which, as I've been arguing, they're not operationalizing the experiments at all. So at least thus far, I don't think there is any cogent reasons to think that neuroscience has provided a disproof of free will. So thank you for your attention.